Hey guys, I hope you're loving the Making Bank episodes. Please make sure you guys like and share these episodes, as well as comment below for the guests. They love to come back and interact with you. And I really appreciate you watching and listening to Making Bank, so thank you.
You are listening to Making Bank, where we uncover the mindset and success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business.
Welcome to Making Bank. My name is Josh Felber, where we uncover the mindset and the success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business today. Super excited for today's guest back on Making Bank. Dr. John Seforek, Ree Perez, Jamie Mustard, Jerry Fetta, Jeff Duden, Forbes Riley, David Meltzer. You know, I talk a lot on my different podcasts and shows and stuff, or other shows that I'm on, just about kind of like life and family and business, entrepreneurial integration and everything. You know, I guess, how did you manage that, making sure you got the time to connect with the kids and the wife and then obviously two businesses, the rentals as well as the chiropractic.
And the flipping, you know, I really look at them as three, right? So there's the rentals growing slowly. I ran out of money, like everybody will. So you move into flipping, and that's a much harder game.
Gotcha.
And
then you have the kids,
you know, that's real. That's a full-time job, flipping. So how do you? That's exactly the question. You have to figure out, and I always say that the people who do it wrong don't communicate with their families. The people who do it right, let them become a part of it. I was vulnerable, man. I suffered financially in my life, and there's not a day my kids didn't know what I was going through. They didn't know my greatest fears. They knew my motivations, my dreams for the family. Well, guess that didn't just happen. That's me sitting down and treating my kids like they were adults. And, you know, they got a great education along the way. And what I found was that the more I brought them in, and the more they saw me and my concerns, my fears, what my real motivations were, the more they supported that. And they will, to this day, tell their friends, and their friends envy the transparency of our relationship, where outside of our family, you might have said, well, look at him. He's gone away from his family. He doesn't care about that. Like, wait a minute, my kids will mist up in their eyes talking about the sacrifice now. Why is that? Because I communicated. So there's ambition, and there's also, that's on you. That's what I say. It's on you, the ambitious person, to make your family a part of that. Don't just run from that. That's your job.
No, that's great. I think this applies to a lot of it right now too, with everything going on with the COVID and pandemic stuff and everything else, is that open communication. Like, what did that communication look like? You know, I guess, what is that back and forth and that depth that you dove into?
Well, if you would imagine sitting down with your wife and just telling her how scared you are because you have shrinking insurance reimbursement, we don't have a whole lot of savings. What does it look like? It looks like me feeling financial fears. And telling them about it, facing that, and really helping them to feel what I'm feeling. It's just me being vulnerable. That's what it is. I mean, if you're not acting like I'm some sort of dad on a pedestal, but rather, and that's the game, right?
Yeah.
My dad was Superman. I mean, God bless him, but I was unprepared for life. My kids come in and they say, oh, in their 20s, so I'm having a rough pothole here at this stage of my life. Ah, dad went through that. Oh, God, it's not working out for me. You know, dad went for that. I remember when dad had his fears. I remember when dad did. They were educated through me. It wasn't hidden. Money, you know how parents will take that off the board and not show you about that? They don't talk about money and sex. Well, they did. I talked everything about money. My kids knew my numbers to the penny. Why would I hide it from them?
Right.
You know? Guys, this is what I'm doing, what I'm doing. And you know, the big number you toss out there, it's like, my whole family, nobody knew that. $240,000. We don't talk about that in Western Pennsylvania, you know, what we make, but I did to my family. And the only reason I bring it up on a podcast like yours is not to impress you, but to impress maybe a listener out there that if I can do that, maybe they can achieve their goals too. It wasn't that spectacular. Like, $240,000 was doable. So maybe your $80,000 is doable too, right? That's the only reason I bring that up. But my kids knew the numbers all the time.
No, and I think that's great. I mean, just
with, you know, a lot of people that are out of work right now, or don't have the money to even potentially pay their rent or their bills or their mortgage and stuff like that, you know, having that open communication to communicate with their family so everybody's on the same page, working towards that same focus and goal, as well as, you know, the people that, whether they're landlords or their mortgage companies and stuff like that, and having that communication so everybody's working together to be able to, you know, stay, you know, at this level, so as they kind of start to move back into the workforce or things like that, they're not so far down in a bad situation with nobody knowing.
I'm sorry, Josh. I don't know about you, but I've always loved when you saw people, when you see people, maybe when they come on your show, and they admit the times when they are down and out. I do that a lot in my book. For that very reason, I admit it. This book was for my son, right? And so I talk about the time whenever I had 3 foreclosures in a row that lost money. That was a whole year. And I came on the biggest foreclosure, the next one, and I was down and out. I fired teams of contractors. And one night, I'm just covered in dust all by myself in this house we dubbed the Titanic. My kids know about this. I'd take a knee and I just sob, man. I'm in my middle 30s. And I tell them, this isn't the worst moment of my life. This isn't the lowest. This might be the best moment of my life, the biggest, because at that point I gave it all. I gave everything. And that's what they have to see that. When they understand that, they say, God, you know, and I'm like trying not to choke up here. They say, look at Dad, look what Dad did. And so they understand it now. They get it, man. But they only get it if you admit it to them. Like, what if I'm trying to be the hero on the pedestal, you know, the knight in shining armor coming home? They'll get that lesson now. And so that's why the communication is so important.
So I guess let's start off, because everybody's like, okay, Ree, why did you come out with a book, you know, titled that way?
Well, first, I want to say, why did I come up with a book? So for years...
I was going to go there next, but go ahead.
I mean, I think it's like, all right, why the book in the first place? Well, and that sort of lends itself to my answer to your first question. But, you know, I've had a lot of people over the years since I left working with the big firms and started working with entrepreneurs and small business owners, that I just had to do a lot of education around really what branding is. It's so much deeper and so much more than a logo and your colors and your website. And so I wanted to sort of set the record straight, and I wanted to create a book that helped to unpack all of these things into a nice, easy to understand, easy to apply sort of manner. And then I decided to name the book this way because I wanted to teach by showing branding in action. And so if you think about it, the book title, it evokes an emotion.
Sure.
It's polarizing. It can be polarizing. And it piques curiosity. So I'm accomplishing all of those things in just a book title. And by the way, the book title, the book cover jacket is pink. Like, how many pink?
I saw that.
How many pink books do you see on the bookshelf or on Amazon or whatever these days? And so I'm sort of demonstrating the power of branding by the book title. So it can mean a lot of different things, right? Your brand should be gay. And then I wanted to be inclusive. So even if you're not, but really the book is about the art and science of creating an authentic brand, because when your brand is authentic, you have to be okay with knowing that you will polarize people. Not everyone's going to love you. Not everyone's going to agree with you. Not everyone's going to resonate with you. And you have to be okay with that and know that it's more important to be authentic as a brand, whether you're a personal brand or a company brand, than it is just to chase the dollar.
Mm. So tell me a little bit about, so we kind of clarify for everyone, what's the difference? Like, what's an inauthentic brand and an authentic brand, I guess, kind of what is that? So we can start from there.
Yeah. So, you know, I know depending on which circles you're in or the conversations you typically have amongst your peers and your colleagues, authenticity is sort of one of those overused words, right? The way that I'm using authenticity in the context of branding is So I've been trained to use, to define brand as creating a desired perception. So the perception that you have, the desired perception that you have is aligned with who you actually are.
Gotcha.
So that it is, so it's not about trying to portray a different image in order to acquire customers or grow your business. If that is not in strong alignment and in congruence with who you are. And that, I think that's really important today, as everyone's sort of wanting to make their mark and be seen, and there's gurus and there's experts and there's influencers and there's people to follow. And that's great and all to model and be inspired by people before us or people who are ahead of us, wherever we're trying to go to. And I think it's equally important to also convey the message that you could still do it in your own unique, authentic way.
Mm. And no, and I think that's true. It's interesting. I was just listening to a book the other day, and they were talking, it was all about like Christian entrepreneurs and everything else. And they were talking about how authentically true like Chick-fil-A is, you know, Christian owners, but then they, it goes all down through their whole staff, their whole team and everything else. And then there was another brand, and I can't remember the name, but I won't mention it regardless if I can't remember it. But there's, they were supposedly Christian entrepreneurs, but then the way they treated like through their employees and everything else was totally opposite of what those so-called, you know, the, I guess the process you'd follow, or, you know, and how you would normally be and treat other people and interact with them and everything.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably a good way to authentic or inauthentic.
That's it. That's an important thing, because I think whether we're a consumer, we're a client of a company that provides services, or we're or we're an employee or a contractor or a partner with a business that is creating a brand, you know, no matter where you are, it's about having those authentic relationships. Mm-hmm. I think we're becoming even more judicious and discerning about who we align with, what companies and what brands we align with. And subconsciously or consciously, I think we tend to gravitate towards the brands that are real, that are genuine.
Right. And you see a lot of brands over the years here recently aligning with different charities and things like that. And it's like, okay, are they really doing it because that's where they believe, or are they doing it because it's just everyone else is doing it?
Marketing tactic. Right. Strategy, or it's a, you know, it's a tool. You know, I said this on a, on another interview also, is sure, those are great tools. And sometimes people can sniff that out when you're using charities as a tool. Authenticity is not a tool. I would say don't use trying to be authentic as a branding or a marketing tool, because at the end of the day, I think we can sort of distinguish when something just is authentic or it's not.
Sure.
When someone's trying too hard to be authentic, if you're trying too hard, you know, if you have to say you're a cool person.
Right.
I mean, why don't you let other people say that you're a cool person, right? So when you're trying too hard to be one way, that, that comes across as inauthentic. Just be who you are.
For sure. Give us a little bit of your background on that part of it, and then how you kind of came to that.
Yeah, so I grew up poor, in abject poverty near downtown Los Angeles. We moved to Eugene, Oregon when I was 12. And I had problems with literacy because I was barely in school pretty much my whole life. And I ended up graduating from the London School of Economics. So I really know what it means to be, and when I say abject poverty, I mean abject poverty, the kind of neglect where you don't go to school, right?
Right.
So I know what it means to feel invisible growing up in poor neighborhoods east of Hollywood near downtown. And so there's a great, it's pretty interesting now that I spend my life helping people stand out. The, you know, one of the things, the major concepts that I talk about in my book is what I call dilution. And we're all experiencing this as entrepreneurs, whether we're successful or not successful. We're all experiencing this thing called dilution. What that means is, Josh, if you were walking around in your town in Ohio in 1950, you would have been exposed to about 250 advertising messages a day.
Okay.
By 1970, that was 2,000 advertising messages on TV, billboards, going to and from the office. Okay. By 1998, that was 5,000 to 7,000 advertising messages a day. And today, the estimates are probably that it's about 10,000 to 15,000. You couldn't process 1,000. So what that means is everyone that you're trying to get to buy into your product or service, no matter how valuable it is to them, and you kind of know in your heart, if they just would look at me, they would use me, right?
Right.
That person is being bombarded with 10,000 to 15,000 advertising messages a day, which means you, no matter how good you are, have become smaller. I have successful CEOs that come to me saying, yeah, we're killing it, but we feel an incredible amount of drag or resistance because we don't feel like half the people that could be using us are even seeing us because we're competing with so much other content for attention. So these primal laws that I outlined in my book, whether you are a guy writing an email trying to get buy-in from your colleagues or your boss, you're trying to communicate to customers, you want them to see you, you know they would use you if they could see you. You've got a new piece of science and engineering, you're an artist, you're a musician, you're giving a presentation. You can apply these primal laws in my book called Blocks, and they instantly circumnavigate this information overload. They lock attention. And by deploying these blocks in a very simple way, they're the primal laws of human perception. You can get someone, I can make something iconic in your mind in a matter of moments by deliberation and at will rather than hope, luck, chance, or years that might take. And that's how blocks work. So that's it. How was that? Did I go on too long?
Yeah, no, that's great. So you mentioned too, I know one of the things was, you know, the amount of ads and everything else. And I know one of the things, and I was just talking with some of our marketing guys a few days ago, was the fact that, I mean, the amount of impressions now compared to what it used to be to get somebody to even have belief, you know, in what you're doing and everything. I see it on the poster too in the back.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, listen, in 1998, there was a woman who was doing research for Microsoft and Apple named Linda Stone. And she coined the term continuous partial attention to describe how people are only partially paying attention. That was 98, before the internet was even rolling, 10 years before social media got into full swing. Okay, so the people you're trying, there's lots of books and there's lots of people that are talking about how distracted they are. What makes me different, what I'm trying to communicate to people is, if I'm distracted, and I am, and you're trying to communicate to me, I'm your potential customer, what does that mean for you? What does that mean for your business if I don't have time to pay attention to you, even though I could use you? What does it mean for your psyche? When you're dealing with entrepreneurs, these businesses are more than just businesses. It's their college, their kids' college tuition. It's their mortgage. It's in America, you know, when you go to a cocktail party, 87% of Americans statistically do not like their jobs. That when we go to a cocktail party, what's the first thing you ask somebody? What do you do?
Yeah.
Right? So right. We have in Western culture, especially American culture, we really define ourselves by what we do, but especially entrepreneurs, because for them, it's about meaning and passion and purpose. And so if you can't get people to look at you and you know if they just would, you would get the business, it actually has severe psychological consequences. And that is, you know, people feel paralyzed. Well, if I can't get attention, why even try? They have anxiety about getting the attention they know they deserve. They feel dissatisfied with their lives because they know they're not getting the attention they deserve. And for some entrepreneurs, it can even result in depression. They become depressed about having something amazing but not being able to get that locked attention because they're competing with so much content. And so that's what blocks are basically the anatomy of what make anything iconic. So you make this big, I teach you how to make this big monolithic thing, because these days anything busy, anything that someone can't understand when they first see you, if they can't fully understand you in their lizard brain before they have a chance to think, they move on and you could have lost them forever. So anything busy in a world overloaded with content gets instantly discarded. So I teach you in the book how to create a road sign that locks attention like a warning label for your business or your email or your science, whatever you do. And then people will lock on, and then I teach you a repetition technique so that it can become iconic in your mind very quickly. So all a block is that simple thing, how I teach you to make that simple thing that locks And then once you repeat it enough and it enters your mind, it becomes iconic. So a block is the anatomy of what causes something to become iconic in the mind of your specific audience.
I guess what were some of those points here? Obviously, you're talking to people and giving them traditional IRAs and mutual funds and things like that. What are you seeing then that 1% above are doing different? And you're like, that just created that mind shift for you.
Yeah, the biggest thing for me is seeing that the top 1%, when they invest, it's very different. You know, they typically aren't investing in financial products. There's a difference between a financial product and an investment.
Okay.
And so when I study the balance sheet of these guys, I can see that they're in things like real estate. They're very heavily invested in small business equity. That's one of the, about 60% of their net worth is in that category. You know, they're using trusts, they're using life insurance, they're using things that aren't talked about and touted. And they're really not using mutual funds. They're not, really using 401ks. You know, I tell people all the time, IRAs have phase outs on income. So that automatically takes them out of that category. They're not using that. And they're very big into like things that are tangible, that they have control over, and things that are proven. A lot of it is things that have been around for hundreds of years and consistently is produced.
Yeah, I know. And one of the things you mentioned too was, using life insurance to generate wealth or income and stuff. How does that, because I've heard it talked about plenty enough times, and I know different people probably listen to like, oh yeah, wait, I've heard somebody mention that before. Maybe kind of dive into that a little bit.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things. So I've coined it as the sacred account. And sacred meaning it's only for wealth building, right? Like for that purpose only.
Okay.
When I went back and studied, I looked at a graph and it showed the top 1% by savings rate. And it showed top 1%, the percentage of income saved, the next 10 to 1% spread, percentage of income saved. And then it showed the bottom 90% and percentage of income saved. And over 100 years from 1913 to 2013, it showed me the top 1%, they're saving about 40% of their gross income.
Mm.
40%. That's a huge number.
Yeah.
And it led me to ask, where are they putting it?
Right.
And so I started to research that. And what I found was the top 1% and also Fortune 500 companies, they put what's called their tier one capital, meaning the highest of highest caliber of their reserves, into whole life insurance.
Hmm.
Now, I was a Dave Ramsey guy, right?
Yeah.
So kind of devil's advocate, I was like, there is no way in hell that you're supposed to use life insurance. This must be a mistake.
Right.
Because life insurance is the devil. And I had all of those mindsets. And so when I started to research it, I saw a properly designed whole life insurance policy that had a very high cash value, meaning like if I put in $1,000, I could borrow like 900 of that thousand like today.
Wow. Okay.
And that $900 was still going to grow while I was borrowing against it to go do real estate with it. And that concept clicked because that's what banks do. Like when I deposit my money in a bank, they lend it out to a bunch of people and they make money on it in multiple locations. And so that's kind of the fundamental of it is I can put money into it to kind of just give people a simple view. The dollars that I contribute, they're going to grow at about a 3 to 5% annual compounding rate tax-free.
Through the whole life?
Yeah, through the whole life policy. I'll be able to borrow 70 to 90% of the value that I've put in. So if I've put in, again, $1,000, I'll be able to borrow out $700 to $900, right? Now, I'll pay the insurance company about 2 to 3% interest cost if I do this right. And if I play my cards right, I'm earning that 3 to 5, and I'm paying that 2 to 3. So I'm actually going to make a positive spread there.
Gotcha.
And then I'm going to take that borrowed money, I'm going to put that into a real estate deal, or I'm going to pay off debt or whatever it might be that cash flows, and then I'll just pay myself back and repeat the cycle.
Okay. And then while the whole time that policy is growing through your contributions and through that 2 to 3% a year.
Right, right. Okay. And it's a cool model. I like to tell people, though, it's not the asset. The asset is the real estate or whatever I'm going to do with the money.
Right.
This is a better holding account than the bank or the 401k or the IRA.
Gotcha. Yeah, because right now, obviously, if you put cash in a bank, you're not making anything.
Yeah. Even when I don't take it out, I'm not making anything.
Right. Yeah, I know. I think they came to us one and they're like, oh, hey, we can move this over here and it's going to make like – a quarter of a point or something. What? You want me to lock it up in a CD for 24 months? So, yeah, no, that's interesting. And I mean, how difficult then are those to set up?
It's not super difficult if someone knows what they're doing.
Okay.
You know, you really have to. So my company, that's one of the things we help people with. There really has to be a certain know-how on how to correctly design a policy. Interestingly enough, correctly designing it means that the agent gets paid less. So
okay.
Logic says a lot of agents either aren't going to do that or they just never learn about it because their managers are not going to teach them an unprofitable strategy. So it's hard to find someone that knows what they're doing, can select the policy, the right company, and really tailor it. But if you have that in line, it's as simple as, you know, financial underwriting, making sure you're not a terrorist or a drug dealer. And then, you know, medical underwriting, you can pass a medical test and you're not going to die as soon as the policy gets issued.
Gotcha. Okay. Because I know a lot of people talk about like trying to balance stuff and things like that, you know, life and work and everything. And one of the things I've always talked about is more about integration, integrating what you're doing to your family and everything else. Maybe kind of give us a little insight there and, you know, with that.
Balance is tough. Because the last 10% of excellence takes 50% more effort. So how do you do that in a balanced environment? And truly, I tell my children, I said, if you're not living on the edge, you're just taking up space. Mm. You know, the edge is where all the good stuff happens. It's out there in the margins where risk and reward meet, and you have the opportunity to challenge yourself and work without a net. And all of the great things happen out on the edge. And if you're too central and you're too risk averse, then you're going to miss some opportunities. So that's the balance, right? Is how do you integrate your values and
right.
and your lifestyle and still find a way to give that extra 50% so you can be excellent and you can be a leader in the industry. And so for me, and it's funny you use the word integration, I haven't used that word before, but you mentioned the coaching that I did. I chose that first of all, I think anytime a leadership opportunity pops up, you should say yes. Your answer should always be yes if there's an opportunity to serve
right.
or an opportunity to grow. And I know as you get more successful, it's about saying no and learning how to say no and saying no to more things than you say yes to. But for me, coaching was a great way to practice leadership on the field. And it's so much like business and so much like franchisees. When you step across the line onto that field, you can't recontract. It's
right.
you've made your choice.
Yeah.
You've launched this business. It's going to be a lot harder than you thought it was going to be, but you have to be encouraged with the fact that if you continue to give the effort that you're going to get where you get to, and it's always going to be harder than you think it is. So integrating the coaching to me, also being able to communicate clearly and provide clarity to be able to build a team in 4 months with maybe a bunch of 11 and 12 year olds by giving them a plan and making it clear and installing everything and then just iterating and repping, putting people in the right seats and properly motivating them and giving a cadence where they're not sprinting all the time so that you can peak at the end. I mean, there's so many similarities to building a business and coaching a team of 12 year olds that for me, that was integration.
No, and I think that's super cool, you know, and relevant. I mean, it's, you know, whether you have a team of employees, you know, working with you, or like you said, 11 and 12 year olds, you know, you got to communicate at a certain level so people understand. You have to be able to rally, get them excited and do all that. And so, you know, I like how you were able to, you know, take what you were utilizing there and both sides of it, whether it was the business or whether through coaching and actually applying vice versa to grow either option that you were doing there.
It was powerful, and it really set the tone for our life and integrating our family life and my personal life with the business life.
I'd like to just kind of touch base, if you don't mind sharing, you know, kind of what some of those things that you've created for your family from being an entrepreneur, but then that's opened up and allowed you guys, like you said, family values and different things like that. So
are you asking me to share about?
Oh yeah. Just, I'm sorry. From a family perspective, what you've been able to, from a creation standpoint through family values, like what other things have you kind of built around your family?
look, you know, we struggle like everybody. We've got adult kids now that are going to school and, you know, we're in the process of leaving home. And we do the best we can, right? And I think the two most precious things in life are time and love. Mm. And if you can give both of those abundantly, you're going to be, you know, you're going to be around the target somewhere. And it's been a challenge with time sometimes now that the kids have moved on a little bit and they've got their life. So now are you chasing them around to help them in their life? Because before we set the agenda. And,
right.
And we could now, just for example, a vacation, you know, when's everybody available for vacation? You're jockeying a calendar with young adults that have other priorities and things to do. So, so far so good. They've treated us well. We love them. We love them to death. And, it's been good so far. We'll see how we'll see how she finishes.
Right. No, that's great. What do you think kind of is your kind of secret or your strategies to make that magic happen?
Number one, having amazing, you know what? He heard that my mouth is right. It's my son, Riker. Thank you so much. He actually snuck in a thing of water. I love you, man. That was just so precious. Number one, and I know you're a dad, I've taken my kids with me everywhere. I didn't have kids until I was 42. And I am grateful that they were healthy. And, you know, you want to get really creepy about this? I almost missed having kids. For 5 years, though, my life was really bad. I raised a young man from South Central who was a little darker than my shirt for 12 years of his life. And he was Dexter Rideout. Beautiful, fun little boy who was taught there was a big difference between being black and white. And for 12 years of my life, I got to live in South Central and hang out with his friends and take him on vacations and show him and tell him that the world was not divided by black and white. Right. Dexter was walking from a haircut to church one Sunday morning, and a kid in his neighborhood was trying to get into a gang, walked up behind him and shot him 10 times in the back and left him for dead.
Wow.
He did that because we don't mentor our kids. We don't spend enough on education for our kids. And we don't do that because kids are only 10% of the population. It's funny, but they're 100% of our future. Doesn't seem to matter to anybody. And by the time politicians and people are old enough to take office and stuff, they don't have kids in school anymore and they forget. Your kids are in school. Mine are just getting out of school. You're going to forget. You're going to forget how important it was, how the teachers didn't work and how the class, it doesn't matter. You're not going to fight for their rights. And it's been fascinating to me growing up. Anyway, Dexter was killed. And why am I telling you? Oh, so 6 months after my baby was born.
Magic that makes things happen.
But you're talking about magic. I wanted kids. A lot had been going on. 9/11 had hit. My dad died right before that happened. And I was a little lost. And I said, you know, I wanted a baby. I was 41 years old. And I thought I was married. And I'm like, if I don't do this now, because I'd worked so hard. And as an entrepreneur, don't lose the balance of your life, because too much work doesn't comfort you at night when there's nobody there and you're sick or you're dying and you want someone to hold you and love you and remember you. It's not that you'd spent one more day in the office. I know that. And so here's the crazy thing. I ended up having to do in vitro, and it was kind of an arbitrary day. We picked a day. If you know how that works, pick a day, you do the whole thing.
Right.
They tell you the day your kids were conceived. My babies were conceived on my mother's birthday, the first year after she passed away. That's pretty cool, right? You know what's cooler?
Yeah.
Josh, they were due on December 7th. That's my dad's birthday, the first year after he passed away. And I got the gift of beautiful boy-girl twins. So you asked me about the secret. I think my secret is having faith. And it doesn't matter what the faith is in. I just, if you believe that there's something bigger than you.
Anyway. Yeah, no, it's for sure. I mean, I know you mentioned, you know, mentorship and all that. I mean, that's, we try to do that all the time with our kids, taking them places, whether it was Joel Polish's events or ClickFunnels or whatever. Our kids are always traveling with us to masterminds and doing different things. And I think it's super important, you know, for that, like you mentioned, to give them those experiences as well as just being able to connect and interact them with people. And I mean, we homeschool too. So that, I think that helps and gives us that opportunity to be able to.
Do you know why they're the most amazing kids? Because they have parents who love them. I do a lot of work with people. I teach now. I teach a couple of courses, one on how to pitch, how to articulate what you want to get to somebody else's ears. And then I teach a little training that you've never heard of, because I only do it by recommendation. I do it 1 day, 2 days a month, with no more than 12 people. And it started in my living room 20 years ago, and it's called Breakthrough. And it's this emotionally shattering 2 days because I found so many people have been hurt, raped, molested. I don't care how many business tools you give them. Sure. If your closet is full of crap, you can't keep hiding it. And one day it's going to explode. And it's a funny thing because when you get clear on whatever level, you sound different. You talk different. And my clients will come to me all the time and say, Forbes, I went through Breakthrough and all of a sudden I've got this, 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 and this. I'm like, isn't that funny? It wasn't all about that. You change. When you change how you look at the way the world looks is just different. And people react to you different. So Breakthrough is one of those heartfelt things that I do. The most important thing that I've found is if you have a loving set of parents, you have all the advantages in the world that you'll ever need.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it, you know, it's an, I grew up that same way, had two great parents. And it was kind of funny, you were mentioning computers and all that. My dad, my dad loved fixing computers, and he was like that tech. And so that's what got me in the computers. We had that Commodore 64, and then when the Commodore Amiga came out, that's what got me started. Is at 14, I started my first business selling Commodore Amiga computers because I wanted one and figured out how to get set up as a dealer.
That's very funny. Actually, I'll tell you, having the very first computer is what pissed me off about Apple. I had that very first computer thing with the little hard drive in, and then all of a sudden they made new software, and the hardware didn't fit the software, and I thought, you guys, very evil, very evil.
Yeah. What kind of changes are you making now with the whole pandemic and how you're looking at things and how you're moving forward with things? With so many people that are either out of work or, you know, not sure what they're going to do because their businesses have shut down. They're going through what you've been through. What is kind of that insights or kind of those steps that you think, okay, hey guys, here's 1, 2, and 3. Here's where I see all this.
Yeah. So let me start with capabilities.
Sure.
So stop looking outside, right? You can't control what's outside.
Right.
You can control what's inside. Your mindset, the way you feel, what you think, say, do, and believe, what you hear and you say, especially. So don't hear the wrong things. You don't have to have continual ambionic negative energy. You don't have to have that. Go seek the information you need. I believe in stable data. If you need to know certain data, go seek it. Don't keep it all day banging in your head and creating a new reality for you. So looking within, we have capabilities. Those capabilities are our skills, our knowledge, and our desire. Those integrate to create our capabilities. The way that we increase our opportunity or stabilize our economy or grow is to align our capabilities synergistically or supplementary to what's making money now or what's stabilized now or some opportunity we feel that's been oversold right now that will rebound in the future to take advantage of that. So look within and develop the skills, knowledge, and desire that are aligned, synergistic or supplementary to an industry, career, or company that's making a lot of money right now, that's stable right now and has been stable before and after, or that you see is going to pendulum swing the other way, something like casinos, right?
Sure.
If you look at human history, casinos usually don't have any economic problems when you can go to them.
Right. Yeah. As long as they're open.
In America, you know, 18 states, or in the last 18 months, 22 states have legalized sports gambling. It's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
But the pendulum swung the wrong way because they were attached to casinos and mass gathering places, and there's no sports to bet on. Eventually there'll be sports to bet on. So I look and say, if you have capabilities that are synergistic to your skills, knowledge, and desire are synergistic to that industry, then go ahead and develop those during this time. But everybody should be looking at those three different things. If you don't know where, there's two where's defined. You don't have to create or guess. Go find an expert, someone that's done 30 or 40 years that have worked in the industry, the company, and go ask them, hey, how's it going? Where do you see this going? How's it today? What do you like? Literally ask for help, which is the second criteria of what I say. Number one, inventory your values. Two, ask a series of questions of how you could be a value service. And most importantly, be radically humble and ask for help. Or go to the stock market. If you can't find an expert, just go to the stock market. Every day, look at the top 50 stocks that are doing really well and see what capabilities you have that are synergistic or supplementary to the industry, career, or company that you're looking at, Or go look at the 50 most stable stocks. There's 50 stocks that haven't moved in the last 3 years, including through the pandemic. Like, they literally have stayed at $49, right? they vary like a quarter.
Sure. Yeah.
Go look and see, right? Go look and see what capabilities you have that are synergistic or supplementary for that stable job. Finally, go look to see the stocks that have been beat up, right? Because usually that means they've been emotionally oversold. If they've been emotionally oversold, it means they'll be emotionally overbought, which means if you have capabilities that are synergistic or supplementary to those, you may get prepared for the next 12 to 24 months to put yourself in a position to capitalize on extraordinary growth. But it's only aligned with your values and your ability to ask and attract, so that you can take advantage of what your thermostat is, right? For your values. It's aligned for you, not for me. Don't vote for what I say or what I want. Go do it yourself. So once you understand your capabilities, now you execute on 5 things. 1, inventory of values. 2, ask and attract. Just know a series of 2 questions and do it every day, in person, on the phone, via email and media, radio, print, and TV, social media, all of those. Think about it. When we were young, most people, if you were asking for help, they're like, oh, I got a card game, you know, a guy that plays with me, or I play golf, or the church group, or the women's group, or the book club. That's the only people know. You know, Akron, Ohio, they're like, yeah, the guy over there, you know. Nowadays, people like you and I, on average, everyone knows 1,000 people.
Yeah.
If you're asking one simple question, do you know anyone that can help me? One of the other big shifts in the paradigm from when I lost everything to now is I used to see everybody as gatekeepers. So I was hyper competitive. I had to overcome objections. I had to go, you know, oversell, back and sell, manipulate to get around something, through it. There's always going to be resistance. And I was an expert at getting over, around, or beneath the gatekeeper. I don't see things that way. In an abundant world, the one I live in, everyone like you are a sponsor. Everyone knows somebody that can help me. And all I got to do is ask, hey, do you know someone that can help me? I'm looking for a babysitter for my kids. I'm looking for a new job. I'm looking for someone to come to my free training on Friday, right? And you might even be a power sponsor beyond just a sponsor. You might actually say, hey, I can help you. And I know people that can help you. I'd love to send everybody to your training on Friday, Dave. It's free. You know, so those are the first 2 things. The third thing changed my life. Student of the calendar, right? And the word study changed my life because I realized that I was lucky.
Right.
Everyone told me, even when I lost money, right? It turned out to be because, you know, I made money right off of losing everything. And like, oh, you're lucky. How does that kid? He falls. Like, my uncle calls me the Phoenix. My mom would say, he falls into the gutter and comes out smelling like roses. He's the luckiest kid. No, I'm not. I'll tell you what I am. I'm a studier. What does that mean? That I pay attention to, and I give intention to, the coincidences I want. And those coincidences, when they occur, people think it's luck. But they don't see the attention that I give. They don't see the intention, what I think, say, do, and believe. They don't see the law of Goya. They see the law of attraction. They don't see the law of Goya. Get off your ass. They don't see the kid who wakes up today, 4 a.m. every single day, consistent, persistent pursuit of my potential and enjoying it. That's what they don't see. So what you need to do with your life is study your calendar. Study what you have planned with a lens of productivity, how much value you're going to provide, a lens of accessibility, how accessible are you to others, and how are you accessing what you want, and a lens of gratitude. The lens of gratitude is important because it allows you to find the light, the love, and the lessons in everything. It allows you to see pain as an indicator. It's a turn signal. That's all it is. It indicates that you have a lesson to learn. And so when you get pain, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, or financial pain, you should get excited and say, oh, I got something to learn. I'm going to learn it, and I'm going to ask for help for someone to teach me it, or I'm going to find it on YouTube or do something in order to effectuate the quickest time in order for me to learn the lesson so I can grow and accelerate and get better and get happier. It's a set up. It's not a setback.
Right.
I study what I have planned, what I don't have planned, the empty space in my calendar, and I study my sleep. Right? You got to study your sleep. It's the number one habit that we share. 8 hours a day, people sharing it. And it's the only time that our ego's out of our way. We've actually naturally cleared the connection between us and the most powerful source of light, love, and lessons. It clears the interference and corrosion that already exists. The fourth thing to do, do it now. This is a simple one. I tell the most difference between successful people and people that don't get what they want are people that do get stuff done are separated from those who don't get anything done. And the way you get stuff done is do it now. 100%, 100% of the things you do now get done. And get things done. It sounds as silly as 100% of all short putts don't go in, but it's that simple. Don't leave your putts short, right? Statistically, you're screwing yourself. Get stuff done, because statistically, if you don't, you're screwing yourself. Every time you get something done, you've saved at least half as much time and you're exponentially more successful. So do things now. If you can't do them now, put them in your calendar for tomorrow, prioritize them by what's most important, and go ahead and study it. Give it attention and intention for the next day. Finally, practice ending fear, right? I'm a ferocious Buddha. When I say that, I mean I am ferocious about identifying when I have the need to be right, offended, separate, inferior, superior, anxious, frustrated, all the ego-based consciousness, and even more ferocious of stopping when I'm accelerating in the wrong direction with all of those feelings. When I become a Buddha, once I stop, I drop down into breathing, 6 deep breaths of Buddha to get clarity, balance, and focus, to get centered, to get neutral, my highest frequency. Then I get ferocious again, and law of Goya applies. I ferociously roll in the right direction. When you are in ego-based consciousness, when you're afraid, your mind, your body, your soul are on fire. What do you do when you're on fire? Stop, drop, and roll.
No, that's awesome. And one of the big things too, like you mentioned, was the breathing. I think that's tremendous. And especially like, during this time, I mean, people are so locked down. I mean, inside and inside themselves, you know, whether it's job loss or whatever, and they aren't breathing, they aren't opening themselves up and resetting that balance or, you know, getting that reset in their system. I think that's very dramatic. I mean, just doing breath work with different people and things like that, it makes such a huge difference, you know, in how our output and what we do on a daily basis, for sure. And I know we only got a few minutes left. I know your whole focus is helping, you know, 1 billion people. So, and I kind of how you broke it down, help 1,000, help 1,000, help 1,000, help those. And so can you go a little bit into that direction and what you're doing and that value that you're creating with that?
Yeah, I think happiness is underrated, right? The way we feel is the thermostat for our lives, and we get confused with a lot of other indicators, and they don't understand the power of happiness and the aggregate of being able to have the perspective to enjoy the consistent everyday, persistent without quit, pursuit of your own potential. Everybody has their own quantum potential. I joke around, but you'll get this. You know, my quantum potential being a basketball player is maybe, you know, being a 52-year-old, over 50, second string guard on the Jewish Community Center basketball team. All right, that's my quantum ability. But when it comes to sales, I have much higher quantum ability, or articulating my ideas or other things that I do. So I think understanding that we all have different potentials and the enjoyment of pursuing those and learning where our highest self lies, where our highest capacity lies, and how to enjoy and find the light. One of the biggest things I learned from being a sports agent is everybody wanted my job. Everybody wanted the jobs of the people that I represented. They all thought they must be happy. This must be amazing. What I learned, and the most valuable lesson through that experience, is that nobody loves what they do 100%. Right? You could take the greatest job in the world, you know, MVP of the Super Bowl, MVP of any sport, golfer, Tiger Woods, whatever. Nobody loves 100%. The people that are most successful have learned to love, right? They've enjoyed the consistent, persistent pursuit of their potential. They love a portion of it. You start really thinking about it. Go ahead and think about being a second grade teacher, and I can predict a percentage that I definitely would love about being a second grade teacher. I'd have to learn to love a lot of other things about it. And so I made my skill set and capability the ability to learn to love and teach other people to learn to find the light, love, and lessons in everything. And so for years, knowing how powerful happiness is, I created the math to make what seemed to be the craziest, biggest, audacious idea I've ever come up with, where people, as always, when I started, they laughed at me, scoffed at me, made fun of me. Now they applaud me because I can find 1,000 people like Josh that I'm very confident that I can teach, to teach 1,000 people, to teach 1,000 people to be happy. And if I do so in my lifetime, that's over 1 billion people, a collective consciousness of happiness, the most powerful emotion ever created that strengthens our emotions, our spirituality, our physicality, and it literally strengthens our immune system as well. So it keeps us healthy, happy, wealthy, and wise, all in one. So that's what I teach every Friday. I don't charge anyone because I am on a life's mission. I know that the more that I receive, the more I can give.
I am Josh Felber. You are watching Making Bank. Get out and be extraordinary.
Thank you for listening to Making Bank. If you have enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And sharing is caring. Follow Josh Felber on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram for more. You can also listen to Making Bank on Amazon Alexa, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and watch on Apple TV, Success Thinkers Network, Amazon Fire, and YouTube.